Depression ensued. Madeline had had her heart set on the University of Iowa. When the rejection letter came, she burst into tears. If it wasn't going to be Iowa, then she wanted Columbia, but that didn't happen either. The applicant pool, the letter said, was especially strong that year. Nor did she get into the University of Michigan. It looked like it would be Bellini or nothing. At that time, Madeline was dating a former USC football player named Jeffrey, who worked as a bouncer at the Coaster Saloon on Mission Beach. She knew Jeffrey had strong feelings for her, but he was a loser. Mission Beach was seedy, and Jeffrey sold drugs on the side. When Madeline told Jeffrey that she was applying to graduate school, he panicked about her moving away and said he would go with her. When Madeline expressed skepticism about this plan, he got a tattoo of her name on the soft underside of his forearm. Mad, the tattoo said, because this was what he called her. Jeffrey was excited to move to Florida and get something going there, which meant getting a job at a bar and finding people to sell drugs to. No, Madeline decided, she wasn't going to Florida. She would not settle for Bikini University, and she would not settle for Jeffrey. Late one night, after his shift, she broke up with him. What transpired next was the worst thing that had ever happened to Madeline. On a night shortly after the breakup, Jeffrey went on a bender of tequila and cocaine, and he showed up at Madeline's dorm room at 3 o'clock in the morning, when both Madeline and her roommate were fast asleep, and he carried Madeline out of the building. He loaded her into the back of a panel van he had stolen from the parking lot of the Coaster Saloon and bound her wrists and ankles with plastic zip ties. He gagged her with a bandana and took her to a motel in Encanto, where he kept her for 52 hours until he finally ran out of cocaine and passed out cold. Madeline was able to make enough noise, banging her elbows against the flimsy hotel wall, that a Hispanic cleaning lady heard her, opened the door, and called the police. After Madeline testified, and after Jeffrey was sent to jail, she wanted to get as far away from Southern California as she possibly could. With the help of her former San Diego State professor, Madeline found a bed for the summer in a writer's retreat on Nantucket Island. The writer's retreat ended up being a bunch of CHEO girls from the University of North Carolina who had majored in English and liked to host poetry slams. But the room was cheap, and Madeline found a job bussing tables at 21 Federal, leaving her days free to write. By the end of summer, she had finished her first piece of writing ever, a novel entitled The Easy Coast, about a young woman who was brutally kidnapped by her loser drug-dealing boyfriend. With further help from her former San Diego State professor, Madeline sent The Easy Coast to 3 agents in New York, and within a week, all 3 had called saying they wanted to represent her. Madeline flew from Nantucket to New York to meet with these agents, and this was how she met Trevor. He had been her pilot. Trevor liked to describe the way Madeline looked when he first met her. She was a beautiful blonde from Southern California on the day her greatest dream was about to come true. That year, in Madeline's memory, was a giant starburst, an explosion of heat and light. Her book found an agent, Red Dreyfus, and shortly thereafter, a $30,000 advance from an up-and-coming editor named Angie Turner at the publishing house Final Word. And Madeline met Trevor Llewellyn, and the two of them fell in love. 9 months into the relationship, they were engaged. By that time, Madeline's book had received 2-starred pre-publication reviews from the notoriously cranky Kirkus and from Publishers Weekly, both announcing the emergence of a startling new talent. Startling new talent! Madeline turned that phrase over and over in her mind as she stared now at her blank legal pad. The Easy Coast hadn't been a huge commercial success. It sold around 15,000 copies in hardcover. But it did well enough that Angie offered her a contract for a second novel. Madeline's next book, Hotel Springford, had been about a girl growing up in a grand, old, storied, and haunted hotel with her banquet waitress mother. It hadn't sold as well as The Easy Coast, but Madeline had written it when Brick was a baby, and she was too consumed with changing diapers and pureeing squash to worry about book sales. After Hotel Springford, Madeline was surprised to feel the urge to write subside, for the first time in her life supplanted by the joys and exhaustion of motherhood. She decided to take a hiatus from writing and just enjoy being a mom for a while. She loved life with Brick. It made the bumps in the road, her three lost pregnancies, Big T's illness and death, bearable. When Brick entered middle school and Madeline's hopes for another child were pretty much dashed, she got back to writing fiction on her own timetable. The result was Islandia, which earned her the 6-figure, 2-book deal and ultimately landed her in her current predicament. It had seemed like so much money last year, but after Red's cut and taxes, what was left was enough to pay off their backed-up credit cards, invest the $50,000 with Eddie, who seemed to make money in his sleep, and rent the apartment. Madeline stared at the blank page. Would scented candles help? It was quiet in the apartment, but Madeline could hear voices and passing traffic out on the street. Mozart or Brahms would block that out. Writing a novel on deadline was hard work, especially when she was so preoccupied. She gazed out the window down onto Center Street. Back in the whaling days, Center Street was known as Petticoat Row, because the men had all gone off on whaling expeditions, leaving behind the women to run the businesses. Petticoat Row wasn't a bad title, but Angie was allergic to historical novels. They didn't sell unless your name was Philippa Gregory. The streetscape wasn't as inspiring as Madeline had hoped. A favor as cherished as a diamond had been cashed in on her behalf. Red Dreyfus was an old-fashioned New York literary agent. He was rotund, he drank scotch, he smoked cigars, and took editors to lunch at the grill room at the Four Seasons, where he ordered the sirloin bloody rare. For some reason, Angie owed him. Angie Turner was whippet-thin. She wore pencil skirts and slingbacks. She drank Chardonnay and picked at salads. Madeline wondered about the favor. She imagined it involved another author, someone deeply respected and badly behaved. She imagined it involved sex, drugs, or money, though more likely it had to do with foreign rights or a publicity gaffe. She would have liked to have parsed the particulars of her emotions with Trevor, but Trevor would be in the air. People thought that being a pilot was hard, but once one knew how to fly, it was actually pretty much the same as driving a bus, but with more sex appeal. Because of the sunglasses, Madeline liked to say. She picked up the display box of bird eggs. They were all delicate and perfect in their eggness, each nestled in a cushy bed of straw in its compartment. Alternately speckled, smooth, and cobbled, with the subtlest variants of colors, white, cream, ivory, porcelain, tint of blue, tint of green. Was the woman who had moved to the Virgin Islands an ornithologist? Madeline had once given a magazine interview in which she said, "Every life contains a novel." Could she reasonably write a novel about a female ornithologist who moves from Nantucket to the Virgin Islands? She knew nothing about the Virgin Islands. A knock at the door startled Madeline so badly that she nearly tossed the box of eggs into the air. "Who?" Madeline was terrified, despite the fact that it was broad daylight and she was smack dab in the middle of town. She still suffered from a lingering case of PTSD even now, more than 20 years after her kidnapping. She was terrified of sudden noises, and she would never have been able to write an S&M novel like 50 Shades. Ropes and blindfolds and gags made her hyperventilate to the point of passing out. Who was at the door? Madeline waited, holding her breath, hoping whoever it was would retreat. Another knock. Steady. Insistent. Madeline's car was in the driveway. Any one of 1,000 people would have recognized her car. Madeline tiptoed over to the door, not wanting her footsteps to be heard. A familiar male voice said, "Madeline, I know you're in there. Open up, it's me." "Me?" Madeline thought. The voice was so familiar. And yet, in her panic, she couldn't identify it. She unlocked the door and cracked it open. "Eddie." Madeline exhaled. "Jesus," she said, "you scared me." He was wearing a white linen shirt and khaki linen pants, and a Panama hat, and the tan Versace loafers he loved so much. This was his summer uniform, and Madeline thought he was pushing the season a little bit. It was warm today at 62 degrees, but it was still far from summer, and here was Eddie, dressed like a pimp in Havana, circa 1955. And yet, the look worked for him. Fast Eddie. He could list a house at 10 a.m., show it twice, and have it sold at 10% above the asking price by afternoon. People loved the Panama hat, which came not from Panama, as people would likely think, but from some place in Peru or Ecuador. Every year someone on Nantucket went as Fast Eddie for Halloween.
"Can I come in?" he said. "Please?"
Madeline ushered him inside. Her pride at having her own place was pretty much quashed once Eddie dragged his assessing eye around the digs.
"How did you know I was here?" Madeline asked. "I haven't even told Grace about this yet."
"How do I know anything?" Eddie said. "I heard it on the street. So what are you paying?"
Madeline thought about lying, but he would find out the truth. He probably already knew the truth. Asking was just a pretense.
$2,000 a month?
Ha!
One short, derisory laugh. Madeline waited for the follow-up. He said,
"I could have gotten it for you for $1,500, maybe $12,000.
He's bluffing, Madeline thought.
"Oh," she said, "but you went with Rachel."
"I did," Madeline said. "She was sort of pushy when I mentioned it, and I didn't want to bother you with it."
"You wouldn't have bothered me," Eddie said. "This is a quiet time of year for me. I could have gotten you this place, and I would have done you better on the rent. Frankly, I'm surprised you decided to use Rachel. After what Calgary did to Hope?"
Madeline thought. Calgary didn't do anything to Hope, except for break up with her a week before the Christmas formal. And, supposedly, he gave the sea-glass pendant necklace, which probably cost all of $30, to another girl, Kylie Eckers. But hadn't teenagers been doing this kind of thing since the beginning of time? Why should Rachel be punished?
"What are you doing here, Eddie?" Madeline asked.
"Once I heard you got a writing studio," Eddie said, "I had to come see it for myself."
She didn't like the way he said "writing studio." It made this decision sound fanciful and absurd, like she had bought a unicorn.
"I'm working," Madeline said, nodding at her blank legal pad.
"Are you?"
"Trying."
"I still haven't read your last book," Eddie said, "but everyone else loved it."
Madeline knew that Eddie had never and would never read any of her work. The last book Eddie had even bothered to crack open was Dune in the 10th grade. Eddie gave himself a tour of the apartment, his interest in her writing evaporating like a bad smell. In the kitchen, he opened the cabinets, then the creaky door to the outdated dishwasher. In the bathroom, he turned on the water in the sink. And in the bedroom, he emitted a dissatisfied "hm." Madeline rolled her eyes. Really, what did Eddie Panchik care about a piddly one-bedroom apartment that rented for $2,000 a month? The only rental he handled was the famous $50,000-a-week house on Low Beach Road, from which he took a whopping weekly commission. Eddie popped out of the bedroom and readjusted his Panama hat in that way he had, giving Madeline a glimpse of his shaved head. Madeline had known him so long she remembered his curls.
"What does Trevor think of this place?" he asked.
"He was very supportive," Madeline said.
"Of course he was," Eddie said. "You deserve your own time and your own space, Maddie. There's no reason to feel guilty about it."
"I don't feel guilty," Madeline said.
"Except you're paying too much," Eddie said.
"Speaking of money," Madeline said. She couldn't believe she was going to bring this up, but there were so few times when she and Eddie were alone together that she felt compelled to at least ask. "Is there any way Trevor and I might see our investment back from you sooner rather than later? I'm not going to lie to you, Eddie. Taking this apartment was kind of a stretch. And Brick wants a car. I would honestly be okay with not making a dime in profit if you could just return the $50,000 to us."
"I'm confused," Eddie said. "Why did you invest with me if you didn't care about profit?"
Why had she invested? Greed,
she supposed, and hubris. Eddie had come to her and Trevor with the opportunity to double their money, and Madeline had been tantalized by the prospect. She and Trevor had been struggling financially for so long. While Grace and Eddie bought a huge house on 3 acres, bought a brand new Range Rover and a Porsche Cayenne, while they let the twins shop online at Saks and Neiman Marcus, that Madeline had been determined to invest with Eddie because she finally could. However, she didn't want to admit this to Eddie. She had outkicked her coverage. "Is there any way we could get it back, say, next month?" she asked.
"Next month," Eddie said.
He raised his eyebrows and gave her a devilish smile, one of his facial expressions that Madeline found attractive.
"You do understand what I'm in the middle of, right? I'm building spec houses. I'm going to build them and then sell them, and we will all see our profit when I sell them. Right now, I'm just trying to get them finished."
"Are you close?" Madeline said. There was a long silence, long enough that Madeline thought perhaps Eddie hadn't heard her, and she was about to ask again when he said,
"No, Maddie, not really. I'm not really close at all."
"But we're still thinking June for a return, right?" she said. "June or at the latest August? That's what you told us back in January, Eddie."
"Yes, Maddie. I know that's what I told you, but things have changed since January. You have to take into account market variations."
Madeline tried not to panic. Eddie was such a canny businessman that she hadn't worried about investing with him for one second. Trevor had warned Madeline that financial deals, loans, investments, what have you, were exactly the kind of thing that ruined friendships. But Madeline had insisted.
"Market variations," she said. She didn't know what that meant exactly, but she figured it meant her money was tied up for the time being.
"Yes," Eddie said. He was giving her his sensitive expression now, which she also liked. Eddie did have a sweetness to him, although it appeared only rarely, and mostly when he was dealing with his daughters.
"I should go," he said. "Leave you to work your magic. We'll see you tomorrow night for dinner. Grace is making shrimp tacos."
Madeline exhaled. One small blessing. Dinner at the Panchik house. Trevor and Brick wouldn't have to eat pizza again. Grace was a phenomenal cook.
"Don't tell her about this place," Madeline said. "I want to surprise her."
"Will do," Eddie said. He suddenly looked keen to leave, pronto. Madeline saw Eddie to the door.
"See ya, Eddie," she said. "Thanks for stopping by."
After Eddie was gone, she flopped onto the sofa. Market variations? They would get their money back, though, right? There was a signed paper somewhere. But Madeline was worried. If she wanted money, she would have to get to work, write this book, make it something special. The mere thought was overwhelming. She needed a nap. Nantucket. Sultan Nash, who had been hired to repaint the outside trim on Black-Eyed Susan's, watched Madeline King park her car in one of the three spots of the blue Victorian across the street. Sultan knew Madeline because he had grown up on the island with her husband, Trevor, playing football at the Boys and Girls Club. He noticed Madeline's turquoise Mini Cooper in the parking spot because he tried to park his pickup truck in that same spot the week before and he'd narrowly escaped being towed. Sultan Nash had been irate about this. He knew it was private property, but he also held tight to the belief that anyone who had been born and raised on the island should be able to park wherever they wanted, whenever they wanted. He had appeared at town meeting for a string of 10 years running and aired this opinion. He waved at Madeline and said, "I wouldn't park there if I were you." She grinned. "I'm renting one of the apartments in this building."
Renting one of the apartments? Sultan thought. Had the unimaginable happened? Had Trevor and Madeline split?
Sultan had seen them both at a wedding the previous fall, and he had noted how deliriously in love they seemed, like newlyweds themselves. At the end of the night, Trevor had done a soft shoe dance for Madeline. He was actually pretty good. And when he was done, Madeline had laid a kiss on him that made Sultan blush. He would have given his right arm for a marriage like that. About half an hour after Sultan saw Madeline enter the Victorian, He noticed Eddie Panchik knocking on the door. Madeline opened the door, and Eddie disappeared inside. Sultan mentioned this to Darlene Lanta, a waitress at the Downy Flake, which was where Sultan ate lunch every day, in an as-yet-unsuccessful attempt to date Darlene Lanta. Darlene said, "So let me get this straight. Madeline King got an apartment in town, and Eddie Panchik stopped by to visit?" Sultan nodded and took a bite of his BLT. Rachel McCann told her husband Andy, or Dr. Andy as he was known to his dental patients, that she had rented Madeline a room of her own, which Dr. Andy, who was a habitual half-listener, due to the fact that the people he was most often conversing with had their mouths wide open, and at least one metal tool inside, and therefore were unintelligible anyway, construed to mean a place of her own. He had never read Virginia Woolf. Rachel also said, "I basically lucked into the rental, right place at the right time, as I keep telling you, sweetheart. I can't believe Madeline didn't go with Eddie Panchik." Dr. Andy wondered if Madeline and Trevor had split. He didn't care to surmise, but he accidentally mentioned what Rachel had told him to Janice, his hygienist, the next morning. Janice was married to a title examiner named Alicia, so she frequently lent a different perspective to the dramas that Dr. Andy told her about, all of which he heard from Rachel. Janice said, "Madeline King moved out? That doesn't make any sense. Are you sure that's what Rachel told you?" Dr. Andy was sure, or pretty sure. He said, "I guess Rachel expected her to go with Eddie Panchik." Janice, being a hygienist, was also something of a half-listener. She heard this as Rachel expected that Madeline would get together with Eddie Panchik. "Really?" Janice said. "That doesn't seem likely, does it? Eddie Panchik? Isn't she best friends with his wife?" Dr. Andy said, "I suppose anything is possible, Janice, but we shouldn't say anything one way or another about Eddie Panchik. He's our landlord. We could easily find ourselves out on the street." Janice said, "I've always thought that Madeline King should write a novel about a dentist's office." Dr. Andy agreed that she should, then walked off to scrub up for his 9 a.m. root canal, leaving Janice to ask her next patient, Phoenix Hernandez, whom Janice counted as one of her many trusted confidants, whether she thought Madeline King should get together with Eddie Panchik now that Madeline had her own place in town. Grace's perennials were starting to sprout. Her spring bulbs were in blossom, narcissus, hyacinths, tulips, and her Japanese cherry trees had thousands of nascent buds. 2 more weeks and those trees would be in full-on luscious pink bloom, just like Grace's heart. Benton came to the house every day at 10. The gift Benton brought her from Morocco was an elaborately cast silver pot for brewing mint tea and 2 etched crystal glasses. When Benton first showed Grace the teapot, her spirits fell. The teapot was neither sexy nor romantic. He might as well have brought her a tagine pot. But going through the ritual, harvesting the most robust spearmint leaves from Grace's indoor herb garden, then boiling water and adding just the right amount of sugar into the curvy silver pot, then pouring the elixir into the etched crystal glasses and sipping, turned out to be a sensual, shared experience. "Do you like it?" Benton asked. "I've never tasted anything so pure," Grace admitted. "It tastes like the color green." Relief, and Grace thought tenderness, mingled on his face. They brewed mint tea every day and drank it as they discussed their plans for the yard. They decided to put in a long, narrow bed of daylilies off the front of the deck. Benton said, "I haven't had much experience with daylilies." "Well then," Grace said, "this is where I will teach you." Grace's grandmother, Sabine, a woman Grace had worshipped for her refined tastes, had raised daylilies in her garden. And as a child, Grace had become entranced, not so much with the flowers themselves, as with their poetic names. Jock Randall, Ice Carnival, Ginger Creek, Maud's Valentine. She and Benton sat side by side at Grace's kitchen table and pored over the catalog. I think we need some masculine varieties, Benton said. How about Rocket Booster, or Piano Man, or Freedom's Highway?
Wolf Eyes, Grace said.
Applejack, Benton said.
His fingers grazed hers as he turned the page, and her ears started to buzz.
I'm partial to sweeter names, Grace said. We should get some Baby Darling.
Please, Benton said. Please don't make me plant a flower called Baby Darling.
Grace laughed.
What about Buttercream? She said.
I'll give you Buttercream, Benton said, if you give me Broadway Starfish.
Look at this one, Grace said.
Bullfrog Kisses. She pointed to the photo in the catalog. That is not a particularly attractive flower, Benton said.
Then again, who would want to be kissed by a bullfrog?
Grace turned the page. She picked out the best-looking flower on the page and said its name before she thought to stop herself.
Blue Desire.
Blue Desire, he said. I like it. He raised his head, and their eyes locked. Grace knew the tips of her ears must be flaming red.
He's going to kiss me, she thought.
He moved in. Their lips were just about to touch. Grace sucked in her breath, and the soft sound this made seemed to send a jolt through Benton. He backed away.
Whoa, he said. I'm so sorry, Grace. I think the names of these flowers are getting me riled up.
Don't be sorry, she said quickly.
She was devastated that he'd stopped. She wanted to go back to where they'd been a moment before, the fun intimacy of selecting flowers. But the magic of that had passed. She closed the catalog and decided to ask him the question she'd been wanting to ask for the past 2 weeks. Did McGuffey go with you to Morocco?
She didn't, Benton said. She got a job teaching sailing out in San Diego. We broke up.
As this news settled over Grace, he drummed his fingers on the table nervously. She said,
So you're a free man?
I'm free, yes, Benton said.
Benton, you're married, Grace, he said, to Eddie, who pays my bills.
I don't say it, Benton said.
He let out a long exhale and stared into his tea. You have a house, you have children, you have a whole life with Eddie. Benton took a sip of his tea. I'm your gardener.
You're a lot more than my gardener, Grace said.
This winter when I got your postcards,
don't say it.
I realized how much you meant to me, Grace said. My friendship with you. This garden, this yard, what we're trying to create here means something to me.
Benton said, You have to stop.
Stop what? Grace said.
Stop how I feel? Stop how you feel?
You don't know how I feel, Benton said. This clammed her up.
She thought, Oh God, it's one-sided. Unrequited. The loneliest word in the English language. How do you feel? Grace asked.
Confused, he said.
She sat with that in silence.
I am not that guy, Benton said. I never have been. And it's not like you're just some random married woman I met at a bar. You're my client.
I know, Grace said.
I am not that guy, he said.
He backed his chair away from the table.
I need to shift my focus.
Away from me, Grace said.
Away from you.
But you do like me, Grace said.
Oh, Grace, he said.
I'm more than like you. The next morning, Benton showed up 20 minutes later than usual, and for those 20 minutes, Grace thought he might not be coming at all. She thought, he's going to drop me as a client. He's going to fire me. He more than liked her, but because of this, they would have to stop working together. When Benton's truck did finally pull into the driveway, Grace felt faint with relief. She hurried out to the backyard, and in order to seem like she hadn't been standing around, waiting for him to show up, she started pulling non-existent weeds in the tulip bed.
Hey, Grace,
Benton said as he rounded the house. He held out a brown box from Petticoat Row Bakery.
I brought you something.
His tone was light. Normalcy had been restored. Grace was relieved, but also crushed. She said, Should I pick some mint?
Hell yes, he said.
In the kitchen, Benton made the tea while Grace washed her hands and tried to calm her nerves. Then together they took their established places at Grace's kitchen table. Benton opened the brown pastry box to reveal 4 pale green macarons with pale pink filling.
I became partial to macarons from a French bakery in Marrakesh, he said, but I think these are just as good.
He held one out to her. Grace accepted the cookie and took a bite. She couldn't help herself. She groaned with pleasure. He said, try it with the tea.
With a sip of the tea, yes.
It was a taste explosion.
He said, do you like it?
Nirvana, she said. He held her eyes and smiled at her, and her heart fell to the bottom of her stomach. He set down his glass of tea. He shook his head at her like she had done something wrong. He said very softly, oh boy. And then he cupped her chin, and he kissed her. Madeline. Brick didn't want to go to the Panchik house for dinner.
Honey, Madeline said, why not?
Brick shrugged. He had come home from baseball practice and collapsed on the sofa. Now his eyes were glued to the TV, ESPN, the sports reporters. Madeline sat down carefully next to him. Honey, she said,
don't feel like it.
This was a first. Brick normally chomped at the bit to get over to the Panchiks whenever Grace invited them for dinner. It was the only time he was allowed to hang out with Allegra in her bedroom. With the door open, of course. Honey, is everything okay with Allegra? Madeline asked.
He shrugged. Dunno.
Madeline stared at her hands. 16 years she had raised this child, but she had never quite mastered the art of getting him to confide in her. Trevor was much better at it. She waited, literally biting her tongue until she tasted the metallic tang of blood. She was rewarded. He said,
I'm not sure what's going on. She's been acting weird. I thought maybe it was a bad time of the month for her or whatever, but now I'm thinking she's probably sick of me.
Would it be awful of Madeline to say that she wasn't surprised? Allegra had positive qualities, chief among them her beauty, her composure, her confidence. What 16-year-old girl had such confidence? She could also be quite funny. She did a dead-on impression of the kid's English teacher, Mrs. Kraft. But there had been something about Allegra since she was young, something superior and entitled and not quite nice that she mostly saved for her mother. She brought Grace to tears on a regular basis, and as Grace's best friend, Madeline had always been there to listen. Yes, that was a horrifying thing for your daughter to say. Yes, that was a selfish and thoughtless action. But she's young. She'll grow out of it. Allegra made Madeline feel relieved that she'd never had a daughter herself.
Sick of you, honey? Madeline said.
How could anyone ever be sick of you?
Weak smile.
Madeline didn't let her true opinions of Allegra surface very often, because Allegra was Brick's girlfriend. He was besotted. At the beginning of the romance, there had been so much kissing and hands everywhere, too, that Madeline had asked them to please stop. She was far from a prude, but all of that newly discovered desire on display was embarrassing. Allegra's blue eyes had flashed silver with her triumph. She had converted Brick to the Church of Allegra. He worshipped her. Allegra made Brick happy, and it was more than sex. When he heard her voice, his face lit up. Madeline and Grace had made a promise when the kids started dating. We won't get involved. They would let Allegra and Brick work out their differences. Madeline had always wondered what would happen if they broke up. She had hoped it would be a mutual decision made when they both headed off to separate colleges.
Please, Madeline said, please come to dinner. You and Allegra can talk things over in person.
No, Brick said. Just tell everyone I don't feel well. He swallowed. It's not a lie. My heart hurts. Madeline smoothed the hair from Brick's forehead.
Oh, honey. Please, Mom, I would really rather hang here alone. You and Dad go.
What about something to eat? I can make you a grilled cheese.
Mom, I'm fine.
Trevor entered the living room,
wearing his green-striped good-luck party shirt. His golden hair glinted, and it looked like he had gotten sun on his face, the start of his summer tan. By August, he would be deep brown, and his hair 3 shades lighter. He looked just as Californian as Madeline, if not more so. "What's going on?" Trevor asked. "Brick wants to stay home," Madeline said. "Maybe we should all cancel. Maybe we should stay home and order pizza instead."
"Nonsense," Trevor said. "Grace went to a lot of trouble. You know she did. She always does. And we're going."
He offered Brick a hand.
"All of us."
"I brought that Malbec you like," Madeline said, setting the wine down on Grace's gorgeous blue Bahia granite, or, as Eddie liked to call it, the sexiest countertop in the world. Grace was busy pushing onions and peppers around in the skillet. Her head was engulfed in fragrant steam.
"You're the best friend ever," she said, imitating what they both called her Barbie New Bedford accent. "Let's have us some."
Outside the glass doors, Madeline watched Eddie hand Trevor a beer and Brick a Coke. Brick settled into one of the rattan deck chairs with canvas-covered cushions. One of the twins came into sight, all long brown hair and long legs and jeans. Madeline hoped it was Allegra. She hoped Allegra would give Brick a kiss from the old days and make Trevor and Eddie blush and cringe respectfully. But it wasn't Allegra. It was Hope. She wore her hair parted down the middle and tucked behind her ears. Her face was a tick off the glorious beauty of her sister's. Her eyes were squintier, her cheeks fuller. But what Hope lacked in glamour, she made up for in grace. She had a quiet, serious soul, and an easy elegance, the likes of which Madeline had witnessed before only in women like Jacqueline Onassis and Audrey Hepburn. Of the two girls, Madeline preferred Hope. She rarely let herself admit this. "The garden is looking good," Madeline said. This was an understatement. The yard and garden dazzled, as always. The rest of Nantucket was still gloomy gray, the grass brown, the trees bare, and the daffodils that lined Milestone Road drooped from weeks of punishing wind and rain. But Grace's yard was green and lush, as though these 3 acres had received sunshine by special order. The flower beds had sharp, precise edges. It looked like elves had trimmed the grass with manicure scissors. Everything was sprouted and ready to burst. There was an oval bed of tulips that would have made a Dutchman cry. It contained 700 bulbs in flame orange, snow white, cherry red, amethyst, and 3 luscious shades of pink, powder, shell, and deep fuchsia. The tulip bed alone was enough to make Madeline believe in God. All of the stonework had been scrubbed, as had Grace's antique cast-iron planters and her 5-foot statue of the Angel Gabriel, bought from a church in Lourdes, which was where Grace had done a semester abroad when she was at Mount Holyoke. There was a park bench, salvaged from the Tuileries, said to date back to the era of Claude Monet and Auguste Renoir. Voluptuous ferns lined the bench in the exact places where Claude and Auguste would have set their butts. At the edge of the property sat the garden shed and the henhouse. The doors to the henhouse were closed tight. The chickens were asleep. Madeline let her eyes linger on the wooden footbridge that spanned the brook. Then the handcrafted birdhouses, then the Adirondack chairs artfully arranged to overlook Pulpus Harbor. The swimming pool, a dark-tiled rectangle surrounded by old paving stones, and the same cobblestones they used on Main Street downtown, was still covered, as was the hot tub. Everything about the Panchik property was paradisical. Madeline had been to the house thousands of times, and every time the sumptuous beauty of the place stole her breath away. She couldn't imagine what it would be like to live with this yard, to see it every second of every day. Madeline's yard was patches of brown dirt, sand, and crabgrass, and at the border of the property a mess of scrubby trees, pricker bushes, and weeds. She had one hydrangea, which grew sickly purple flowers. Grace's hydrangeas, numbering 22, were all pageant winners. They bloomed in blue, purple, pink, white, and green. Madeline hadn't even known green hydrangeas existed. But yes, they were called limelight hydrangeas, and Grace's were divine. "Benton has been here," Grace said. "Yes, I can tell,"
Madeline said, because I only hear from you once every 3 days.
Grace's expression was hard to read. It was half apologetic smile, half something else.
Wine, please, she sang out. I'd love some wine.
Madeline pulled two of Grace's baccarat goblets out of the cabinet. Grace liked to use the goblets on Wednesday nights, even though they were fragile, and each one cost as much as a night's stay in the penthouse at the Four Seasons. Madeline had broken one goblet, Grace had broken one, and Eddie had broken two in consecutive weeks. Madeline poured two lavish glasses of the plummy Malbec and brought one to Grace at the stove.
I have some news, she said.
You and me both, Grace said. She took a swill of her wine, then set the goblet down on the sexy granite. But mine is going to have to wait until later. What's yours?
Madeline sucked in a preparatory breath.
She worried that Grace would be mad that she had rented the apartment from Rachel McMahon, and possibly also that she'd taken the apartment without showing Grace first. She said,
I rented an apartment in town.
What? Grace yelped. It's not what it sounds like, Madeline said. I'm going to use it as a writing studio.
Grace's face lit up, and she imitated the patrician accent of her grandmother, Sabine.
Splendid, my darling. Where in town?
In the Blue Victorian on the corner of India and Center.
I've always loved that building, Grace said. She turned down the heat under the onions and peppers and came over to give Madeline a hug.
So you're a real working girl now, with office space of your own. I'm so jealous, but you deserve it.
Madeline said, That's what everyone keeps saying, but I'm not sure it's true. It was pretty expensive.
How much? Grace asked.
$2,000 a month.
Eh, Grace said, shrugging. She returned to the stove and picked up her wine. That seems reasonable for town in summer.
Right, Madeline thought. It would seem reasonable to Grace, because Grace had never worried about money a day in her life.
Grace had been raised in an old Puritan family, the Harpers of Salem, Massachusetts. Grace's ninth great-grandfather had been the attorney who defended Bridget Bishop, one of the women accused of being a witch.
I am no witch. I am innocent. I know nothing of it.
Hanged, June 10th, 1692. Grace had three older brothers, the Harper boys, all of them now civil rights attorneys in Boston. Grace and her brothers had been forced to dress for dinner every night growing up in their majestic brick mansion on Essex Street. On the maternal side of the family was Grandmother Sabine, who owned a 300-acre estate in Wayland that Grace used to visit every Sunday. These afternoons included games of croquet in the summer and sleigh rides in the winter. Madeline had always loved hearing details of Grace's upbringing. She savored them like petit fours, but she couldn't expect Grace to understand what feeling financially strapped was like.
And listen, Madeline said, wanting to be truthful, because that was her nature. I heard about the apartment through Rachel McMahon.
Ugh, Grace said.
Eddie is all bent out of shape about it, I think. He stopped by to see the place, and he seemed unhappy I'd gone through Rachel. But it happened by accident. I opened my big mouth, and you know Rachel.
Pushy, Grace said.
She seized the moment, Madeline said. If I'd taken time to collect my wits, if I'd been, you know, hunting for a place, I would have called Eddie. You know I would have.
Grace waved her hand dismissively. Eddie will get over it, she said. Madeline felt nearly dizzy with relief. She hadn't expected Grace to take the news on such an even keel. Grace was wound pretty tightly most days, and news like this could catapult her into unreasonable territory. But tonight, Grace was in an exceptional mood. Madeline couldn't remember the last time she'd seen her friend so playful, so relaxed. She was practically glowing.
Go outside with the boys, Grace said. I'm almost finished up here.
Madeline, Eddie said. He kissed her cheek. Long time no see.
Eddie, she said, air kiss, and the expected waft of Eternity by Calvin Klein, which he had started wearing right out of high school. He smiled at Madeline crookedly, then hovered a hand above the grill to see if it was ready.
Eddie said to Trevor, So what do you think about your girl's new digs?
I think it's great, Trevor said.
He swatted Madeline on the butt. No more excuses about not getting anything done. Now she should be writing a book a year, or two books a year, like that other Nantucket novelist.
Two books a year, Eddie said. Then you could not only invest in my spec houses, you could buy one.
Madeline tightened her fingers around the delicate stem of the baccarat wineglass. Hearing Eddie bring up the spec houses made her tense enough to snap it. Madeline took Trevor's arm. Let's walk to the bridge. They strolled across the wide swathe of soft emerald lawn toward the footbridge that crossed the brook. The sound the water made when it ran over the rocks was musical, like chimes. Madeline closed her eyes briefly and tried to savor the sound. It was the type of rocks Benton Co. had used, or the way he'd positioned them.
Listen, she said. I asked Eddie for our 50 grand back.
You did? Trevor said. When?
Yesterday, she said. He stopped by the apartment.
He did? Trevor said. I don't know how I feel about you entertaining strange men in that place. After all, I haven't even seen it yet.
His tone was jokey, but Madeline sensed he was a little miffed.
He came by to tell me how mad he was that I'd rented it from Rachel, Madeline said.
Oh, Trevor said, and she felt him ease up. That sounds like our friend, Fast Eddie.
Just tell me it's going to be okay, Madeline said. I'm going to write another book, and we're going to get our money back.
Trevor kissed her, then took both of her hands in his. It's going to be okay. Madeline turned around. Eddie, Hope, and Brick were all unabashedly staring at them, and Grace, too, from inside the kitchen.
Eddie called out, What you doing over there? Proposing marriage?
They walked back to the patio, where Grace had laid out her standard appetizer spread. Smoked bluefish pâté, rosemary flatbreads, farmhouse cheddar, fig jam, roasted peppers, Marcona almonds, Armenian string cheese, and a stick of herbed salami with two kinds of mustard. There were Bremner wafers and soft unsalted butter for Eddie, which he ate for his heartburn. And there were Triscuits and Cheese Whiz for Brick because it was his favorite snack, and Grace always kept it on hand for him. Brick didn't seem cheered by the fresh can of Cheese Whiz, however. There was still no sign of Allegra. Eddie raised his glass of wine.
Here's to Madeline's new apartment, he said. Congratulations.
Hope. Allegra didn't come down to dinner until the very last minute. Their mother had called up to her 3 times, and then Eddie called up to her. Eddie was the only person who held sway over Allegra because he was the one who paid her credit card bill. Allegra came out onto the deck, her eyes glued to her phone, her thumbs flying. Hope said, Who are you texting? Everyone else grew quiet, not because anyone else, except for Brick, cared whom Allegra was texting, but because Hope rarely spoke, and so when she did, everyone made a point to listen.
Nobody, Allegra said. She finished up and slid the phone into the front pocket of her sleek leather jacket. She was wearing her skinny citizens, black ballet flats, a black lace blouse from Dolce Vita, and the soft caramel leather jacket. She looked like she'd just climbed off the back of some guy's Ducati on the Italian Riviera. She beamed at the assembled families as if shocked and delighted to find them all there, as if she hadn't heard them from upstairs in her bedroom for the past half hour.
"Hey, everyone," she said. "Hey, Brick."
Brick made an eighth of a turn in his chair, then waved in her general direction.
"Hey."
It was strained. But did he know about Ian Coburn? No, Hope didn't think so. Allegra had managed to keep her mouth shut about Ian. She hadn't even told her sworn bestie, Hollis. "Hollis doesn't need to know," Allegra had said on one occasion. And then on a second occasion she said, "If I told Hollis, the entire school would know before we finished saying the pledge. I love that girl, but she cannot keep a secret." The only person she had told about Ian Coburn was Hope. Ian Coburn was taking his final exams at BC. He would be back on Nantucket the following week.
"What are you going to do then?"
Hope had asked her sister.
"What do you think I'm going to do?" Allegra said.
Hope had no idea.
She could see Allegra breaking up with Brick, and she could also see Allegra breaking up with Ian Coburn. And she could easily see Allegra having the ego to try to juggle both boys over the summer. Hope had said, "You're going to play it by ear? Wait and see how it goes?"
"Exactly," Allegra said. Of course, this was her sister's answer. Allegra believed in nothing so strongly as her own good fortune and in things working out in her own best interest. But she would blow it.
Allegra put a hand on Brick's shoulder and then bent over and kissed the top of his head like she was his mother. Hope felt a pang for Brick. Was it not totally obvious that Allegra's reservoir of sexy romantic feelings for him had run dry, and that she was preoccupied by her phone, which they could all hear vibrating away in her jacket pocket?
"Who's texting you?" Brick asked.
"Texting me?" Allegra said. She smiled innocently as though she couldn't feel the persistent vibration of Ian Coburn's messages against her left breast. She plucked her phone from her pocket and checked the display. "Oh, it's Hollis. She's asking about math."
She was a born liar, Hope thought. It was incredible. She should skip the modeling career and go straight to politics.
"I don't believe you," Brick said. "Show me the text."
He reached out to grab Allegra's phone, but in the process, he hit Madeline's glass of red wine, which shattered and sent a Malbecian spray all over Allegra's Italian leather jacket. Allegra shrieked. Madeline said, "Oh, Brick, no!" Trevor said, "Honey, it was an accident." Madeline set about picking up pieces of the wine glass while Allegra whipped off her leather jacket, taking her phone out of her pocket first and setting it on the dry part of the table, right where both Hope and Brick could see it, when Ian Coburn texted yet again.
"Ian Coburn?" Brick said. "Since when do you get text from Ian Coburn?"
"Jesus, Brick!" Allegra said. "This jacket cost me a fortune."
Eddie cleared his throat.
"Me a fortune," he said. "Is it ruined?"
Allegra wiped at it with napkins, but the wine had left a shower of dark stains that looked like splattered blood.
"It's an Italian jacket, right?" Hope said. "You'd think they would make them wine resistant."
"I can't believe this," Allegra said.
Grace got a sponge for the wine, and Madeline threw the shards of glass into the trash. Grace said, "Do you want the sponge for your coat, honey?"
"You can't put water on it, mother," Allegra said. "Tone," Eddie warned.
Allegra's phone continued to buzz. Her family was so predictable, Hope thought. Possibly they believed that she, too, was predictable. But nobody knew that in a month, maybe two, she would be dating Brick.
Brick said, "Ian Coburn sure has a lot to say to you."
Allegra snatched up her phone.
"It's none of your business who texts me."
"Really?" he said.
"I'm putting the shrimp on," Eddie said.
"I think maybe we should go home," Madeline said. Grace handed Eddie a large platter of shrimp and jalapeno skewers. When he laid the first one on the hot grill, there was an angry hiss. Grace said,
"You should not go home. It's just a glass and a little spill."
"But, Eddie, you need to apologize to Madeline for giving her a hard time about Rachel McMahon." Rachel McMahon, Hope thought. Ew. Rachel was the mother of Hope's sworn enemy, Calgary McMahon. Hope had dated Calgary for 4 weeks before she finally allowed him to get to third base. But he broke up with her right after, making Hope feel like there was something wrong with her. When Calgary and his friends saw Hope in the hallway, they made a strange hand motion that Hope didn't understand, and there was no one she could ask, but she knew it wasn't good. In response, she flipped them off, which made them laugh. Calgary had left Hope without a date for the Christmas formal. The red velvet cocktail dress that she and Grace had bought at Hepburn went unworn. Calgary had asked Kylie Eckers to the formal, but Kylie got so drunk at the pre-party that the principal and superintendent stopped her at the door and called her parents to come pick her up. When Hope heard that news from Allegra the next morning, she felt somewhat vindicated. But now, 5 months later, her hatred of both Kylie and Calgary had become indelible, like a fossil in rock.
Rachel McMahon wasn't worthy of your commission, Eddie said. That was my only point.
I don't think she took a commission, Madeline said.
Oh, believe me, she took a commission, Eddie said.
Just the name Rachel McMahon made Hope feel sick. She couldn't stand another second of this conversation.
Mom, she said, I'm not hungry. I'm not hungry either, Brick said.
He looked at Madeline. Can we go home, Mom, please?
Yes, Madeline said.
I think we should. That was the last thing Hope heard before she marched upstairs, except for the buzzing of Allegra's phone. Madeline.
You can't go, Grace said. We haven't eaten yet. I made fresh pineapple salsa. I made mango panna cotta.
I don't feel well, Brick said. Can you hang on a little while longer, buddy? Trevor asked. We'll eat, and then we'll go.
Madeline was all for trying to set things right. She felt awful that Brick had broken another one of the $500 wine goblets. But this led to annoyance that Grace insisted on using such expensive crystal for casual family dinners in the first place. Madeline felt like she should offer to pay for the glass, or for Allegra's jacket, even though she didn't have the money. Although, clearly, she did have the money because she was blowing $2,000 a month on the rent for a room of her own. Madeline collapsed in a rattan chair, defeated. Then she popped back up. She wanted more wine. She would drink it from a juice glass. Grace followed her into the kitchen.
I don't want you to leave until you and I have a chance to talk in private. We'll go upstairs after dinner. This isn't something I can discuss on the phone.
Oh, Madeline said. Okay.
Dinner's ready, Eddie called.
Conversation at dinner was interrupted by the insistent buzzing of Allegra's phone.
Eddie finally said, Allegra, turn it off or take it inside.
Ian Coburn must really want to talk to you, Brick said.
Allegra said, we're friends, okay? Is that not allowed?
Trevor said, the salsa is delicious.
Thank you, Grace said. Eddie, Madeline noticed, hadn't touched his food. He was still picking Bremner wafers off the appetizer plate.
It's allowed, Brick said. Of course it's allowed, as long as you're only friends. As long as that's all it is.
Of course that's all it is, Allegra said. She threw her embroidered napkin on top of her taco mess. Grace, Madeline knew, laundered and ironed each napkin before these dinners.
How dare you suggest otherwise?
Otherwise, Madeline thought. Something was going on between Allegra and Ian Coburn. She felt a hot, pulsing anger. Then she remembered her vow with Grace. We won't get involved.
Allegra, Brick said.
But Allegra was up and out of her chair, her phone tucked into the pocket of her ruined jacket. She said,
Save it, Brick,
and disappeared into the kitchen. Brick looked like he wanted to chase after her, but he stayed put. Madeline finished her glass of wine. She stood up to refill her glass, but Grace said, It's gone. Do you want Eddie to grab another bottle from the cellar?
No,
Madeline thought. They should go. Poor Brick had been humiliated enough for one night. But Grace had something to tell her that couldn't be discussed over the phone, and Madeline was intrigued.
Yes, she said.
Eddie brought up two bottles of Screaming Eagle Cabernet, and Madeline blinked.
Was she seeing things? He'd always said he was saving those bottles for his deathbed.
Madeline said, Edward, what are you doing?
He said, I want to pour this tonight. I'm not sure why. It's just a gut feeling.
That's as good a reason as any, Trevor said. I can't wait to taste it.
Grace went into the kitchen to bring everyone a fresh baccarat wine goblet.
Brick said, You're having more wine? I thought you said we could go, Dad.
Trevor said, This is the best wine any of us are likely to taste. Eddie spent how long on the wait list?
8 years and 7 months, Eddie said proudly.
I don't care, Brick said. Sorry, Mr. Panchik, I just want to go.
They should go, Madeline thought.
Brick never complained. They should save the screaming eagle for a night when there was something to celebrate, such as the spec houses selling and a major return on her and Trevor's investment coming in. But Eddie pulled the cork and started pouring the adults' wine. They all touched glasses in a moment of peace. Allegra poked her head out of her bedroom window and called down to the deck. "Brick, would you come up here, please?" Madeline watched indecision cross her son's face. "Please, Brick," Allegra said. Brick stood up and went inside. "Good," Grace whispered. "They'll work things out."
Ian Coburn, Madeline thought.
He was a very good-looking kid who had graduated from Nantucket High School the year before. His father was a private equity guy who commuted back and forth to New York City. His mother was shrill and oblivious to everything but her son's charms. Ian Coburn had been one of the kids who had been allowed to have parties and serve alcohol with his parents' blessing. He was, Madeline thought, bad news. "We won't get involved."
"Keep the door open," Eddie called out.
Grace refilled her and Madeline's glasses while Eddie watched how much of his precious wine left the bottle. Grace said, "I have something I want to show Madeline upstairs. Will you boys be all right out here by yourselves?"
"Cigars,"
Eddie said to Trevor.
"I hear ya," Trevor said. "Ooh, look," Eddie said. "I have two cohibas right here in my pocket."
Madeline followed Grace inside, through the kitchen and up the grand, sweeping staircase. One could fit three or four of the Llewellyn's house inside the Panchik house, but Madeline had given up on envy long ago. It was fruitless. They entered Grace's study, which was a near-exact replica of her grandmother Sabine's study at the estate in Wayland. The room was too dark and formal for Madeline's sunny tastes, although it was elegant. There were hunting prints on the taupe walls, built-in walnut bookshelves, and thick brocade drapes. Grace had inherited the enormous ornately carved mahogany desk from Sabine, along with a thick Persian rug, hundreds of thousands of silk knots in burgundy and navy and cream. Madeline inhaled. She did love the way the room smelled, like sandalwood and old books. Grace had been a French literature major at Mount Holyoke, so her shelves were lined with Victor Hugo and Voltaire, Colette and Proust, Emile Zola, Dumas, Camus. She had a collection of 24 Ted Muelling candlesticks, which held an assortment of slender white, ivory, and dove gray candles. She had an antique inkpot and a quill pen that actually worked. A banjo clock ticked on the wall and announced the passing of every 15 minutes in a brassy tenor. Grace shut and locked the heavy door and dimmed the lights on the huge pewter chandelier that hung from the ceiling.